This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Another reading today from John Muir's The Story of My Boyhood and Youth, Growing Up in the Wilds of Wisconsin Wilderness. The wonderful thing that he did at the end of his life was to write down his vivid memories of growing up, starting when he arrived in Wisconsin at age 11 from Dunmore, Scotland. He was born in 1838. This time, we'll find him plowing the prairie grasses with oxen and mastering the difficult job, and then being set forth to dig an incredible 90-foot-deep well for water all by himself, hoisted up and down twice a day by his father. And then when he's a little older, bee lining, finding honeybees. John Muir died in 1914 and wrote this the year before he died. What a gift for us. And now John Muir. After 8 years of this dreary work of clearing the Fountain Lake Farm, fencing it and getting it in perfect order, building a frame house and the necessary outbuildings for the cattle and horses, after all this had been victoriously accomplished and we had made out to escape with life, Father bought a half section of wild land about 4 or 5 miles to the eastward and began all over again to clear and fence and break up other fields for a new farm, doubling all the stunting, heartbreaking chopping, grubbing, stump digging, rail splitting, fence building, barn building, house building, and so forth. By this time, I had learned to run the breaking plow. Most of these plows were very large, turning furrows from 18 inches to 2 feet wide, and were drawn by 4 or 5 yoke of oxen. They were used only for the first plowing, in breaking up the wild sod woven into a tough mass, chiefly by the cord-like roots of perennial grasses, reinforced by the taproots of oak and hickory bushes called grubs, some of which were more than a century old and 4 or 5 inches in diameter. In the hardest plowing, on the most difficult ground, the grubs were said to be as thick as the hair on a dog's back. If in good trim, the plow cut through and turned over these grubs as if the century-old wood were soft like the flesh of carrots and turnips. But if not in good trim, the grubs promptly tossed the plow out of the ground. A stout Highland Scot, our neighbor, whose plow was in bad order, who did not know how to trim it, was vainly trying to keep it in the ground by main strength, while his son, who was driving and merrily whipping up the cattle, would cry encouragingly, "Howled her in, feyther! Howled her in!" On the contrary, with the share and coulter sharp and nicely adjusted, the plow, instead of shying at every grub and jumping out, ran straight ahead without need of steering or holding, and gripped the ground so firmly that it could hardly be thrown out at the end of the furrow. Our breaker turned a furrow 2 feet wide, and on our best land, where the sod was toughest, held so firm a grip that at the end of the field my brother, who was driving the oxen, had to come to my assistance in throwing it over on its side to be drawn around the end of the landing, and it was all I could do to set it up again. But I learned to keep that plow in such trim that after I got started on a new furrow, I used to ride on the crossbar between the handles with my feet resting comfortably on the beam, without having to steady or steer it in any way on the whole length of the field, unless we had to go round a stump, for it sawed through the biggest grubs without flinching. The growth of these grubs was interesting to me. When an acorn or hickory nut had set up its first season's sprout, a few inches long, it was burned off in the autumn grass fires, but the root continued to hold on to life, formed a callus over the wound, and sent up one or more shoots the next spring. Next autumn, these new shoots were burned off, but the root and calloused head, about level with the surface of the ground, continued to grow and send up more new shoots, and so on, almost every year, until very old, probably far more than a century, while the tops, which would naturally have become tall, broad-headed trees, were only mere sprouts, seldom more than 2 years old. Thus the ground was kept open like a prairie, with only 5 or 6 trees to the acre, which had escaped the fire by having the good fortune to grow on a bare spot at the door of a fox or a badger den, or between straggling grass tufts, wide apart on the poorest sandy soil. The uniformly rich soil of the Illinois and Wisconsin prairies produced so close and tall a growth of grasses for fires that no tree could live on it. Had there been no fires, these fine prairies, so marked a feature of the country, would have been covered by the heaviest forest. As soon as the oak openings in our neighborhood were settled and the farmers had prevented running grass fires, the grubs grew up into trees and formed tall thickets, so dense that it was difficult to walk through them, and every trace of the sunny openings vanished. We called our second farm Hickory Hill, from its many fine hickory trees and the long, gentle slope leading up to it. Compared with Fountain Lake Farm, it lay high and dry. The land was better, but it had no living water, no spring or stream or meadow or lake. A well 90 feet deep had to be dug, all except the first 10 feet or so in fine-grained sandstone. When the sandstone was struck, my father, on the advice of a man who had worked in mines, tried to blast the rock, but from lack of skill, the blasting went on very slowly, and father decided to have me do all the work with mason's chisels, a long, hard job with a good deal of danger in it. I had to sit cramped in a space about 3 feet in diameter and wearily chip, chip with heavy hammer and chisels from early morning until dark, day after day, for weeks and months. In the morning, Father and David lowered me in a wooden bucket by a windlass, hauled up what chips were left from the night before, and then went away to the farm work and left me until noon, when they hoisted me out for dinner. After dinner, I was promptly lowered again, the forenoon's accumulation of chips hoisted out of the way, and I was left until night. One morning, after the dreary bore was about 80 feet deep, my life was all but lost in deadly choke damp, carbonic acid gas that had settled at the bottom during the night. Instead of clearing away the chips as usual when I was lowered to the bottom, I swayed back and forth and began to sink under the poison. Father, alarmed that I did not make any noise, shouted, "What's keeping you so still?" To which he got no reply. Just as I was settling down against the side of the wall, I happened to catch a glimpse of a branch of a bur oak tree which leaned out over the mouth of the shaft. This suddenly awakened me, and to Father's excited shouting, I feebly murmured, "Take me out!" But when he began to hoist, he found I was not in the bucket, and in wild alarm shouted, "Get in! Get in the bucket and hold on! Hold on!" Somehow I managed to get into the bucket, and that is all I remembered until I was dragged out, violently gasping for breath. One of our near neighbors, a stonemason and miner by the name of William Duncan, came to see me, and after hearing the particulars of the accident, he solemnly said, "Weel, Johnny, it's God's mercy that you're alive. Many a companion of mine have I seen dead with choke damp, but none that I ever saw or heard was of so near to death in it as you were, and escaped without help." Mr. Duncan taught Father to throw water down the shaft to absorb the gas, and also to drop a bundle of brush or hay attached to a light rope, dropping it again and again to carry down pure air and stir up the poison. When, after a day or two, I had recovered from the shock, Father lowered me again to my work, after taking the precaution to test the air with a candle and stir it up well with a brush and hay bundle. The weary hammer and chisel chipping went on as before, only more slowly, until 90 feet down, when at last I struck a fine, hearty gush of water. Constant dropping wears away stone. So does constant chipping, while at the same time wearing away the chipper. If Father never spent an hour in that well. He trusted me to sink it straight and plumb, and I did, and built a fine covered top over it, and swung two iron-bound buckets in it, from which we all drank for many a day. The honeybee arrived in America long before we boys did, but several years passed ere we noticed any on our farm. The introduction of the honeybee into flowery America formed a grand epoch in bee history. This sweet humming creature, companion and friend of the flowers, is now distributed over the greater part of the continent, filling countless hollows in rocks and trees with honey, as well as the millions of hives prepared for them by honey farmers who keep and tend their flocks of sweet winged cattle as shepherds keep sheep, a charming employment, like directing sunbeams, as Thoreau says. The Indians call the honey bee the white man's fly, and though they had long been acquainted with several species of bumblebees that yielded more or less honey, how gladly surprised they must have been when they discovered that in the hollow trees, where before they had found only coons or squirrels, they found swarms of brown flies with 50 or even 100 pounds of honey sealed up in beautiful cells. With their keen hunting senses, they of course were not slow to learn the habits of the little brown immigrants and the best methods of tracing them to their sweet homes, however well hidden. During the first few years, none were seen on our farm, though we sometimes heard father's hired men talking about lining bees. None of us boys ever found a bee tree, or tried to find any until about 10 years after our arrival in the woods. On the Hickory Hill farm, there is a ridge of moraine material, rather dry, but flowery, with goldenrods and asters of many species, upon which we saw bees feeding in the late autumn, just when their hives were fullest of honey, and it occurred to me one day after I was of age and my own master that I must try and find a bee tree. I made a little box about 6 inches long and 4 inches deep and wide, bought 1/2 pound of honey, went to the goldenrod hill, swept a bee into the box and closed it. The lid had a pane of glass in it, so I could see when the bee had sucked its fill and was ready to go home. At first it groped around trying to get out, but smelling the honey it seemed to forget everything else, and while it was feasting, I carried the box and a small sharp-pointed stake to an open spot where I could see about me, fixed the stake in the ground, and placed the box on the flat top of it. When I thought that the little feaster must be about full, I opened the box, but it was in no hurry to fly. It slowly crawled up to the edge of the box, lingered a minute or two, cleaning its legs that had become sticky with honey, and when it took wing, instead of making what is called a beeline for home, it buzzed around the box and minutely examined it as if trying to fix a clear picture of it in its mind, so as to be able to recognize it when it returned for another load, and then circled around at a little distance as if looking for something to locate it by. I was the nearest object, and the thoughtful worker buzzed in front of my face and took a good stare at me, and then flew up on the top of an oak on the side of the open spot in the center of which the honey box was. Keeping a keen watch, after a minute or two of rest or wing cleaning, I saw it fly in wide circles around the tops of the trees nearest the honey box, and after apparently satisfying itself, make a beeline for the hive. Looking endwise on the line of flight, I saw that what is called a beeline is not an absolutely straight line, but a line in general straight, made of many slight wavering lateral curves. After taking as true a bearing as I could, I waited and watched. In a few minutes, probably 10, I was surprised to see that bee arrive at the end of the outleaning limb of the oak mentioned above, as though that was the first point it had fixed in its memory to be dependent on in retracing the way back to the honey box. From the treetop it came straight to my head, thence straight to the box, entered without the least hesitation, filled up and started off after the same preparatory dressing and taking of bearings as before. Then I took particular pains to lay down the exact course so I would be able to trace it to the hive. Before doing so, however, I made an experiment to test the worth of the impression I had that the little insect found the way back to the box by fixing telling points in its mind. While it was away, I picked up the honey box and set it on the stake a few rods from the position it had thus far occupied and stood there watching. In a few minutes, I saw the bee arrive at its guide mark, the overleaning branch on the treetop, and thence came bouncing down right to the spaces in the air which had been occupied by my head and the honey box, and which the cunning little honey gleaner found nothing there but empty air. It whirled around, and when the cunning little honey gleaner found nothing there but empty air, it whirled round and round as if confused and lost. And although I was standing with the open honey box within 50 or 60 feet of the former feasting spot, it could not, or at least it did not, find it. Now that I had learned the general direction of the hive, I pushed on in search of it. I had gone perhaps a quarter of a mile when I caught another bee, which, after getting loaded, went through the same performance of circling round and round the honey box, buzzing in front of me and staring me in the face to be able to recognize me. But as if the adjacent trees and bushes were sufficiently well known, it simply looked around at them and bolted off without much dressing, indicating, I thought, that the distance to the hive was not great. I followed on and very soon discovered it in the bottom log of a cornfield fence, but some lucky fellow had discovered it before me and robbed it. The robbers had chopped a large hole in the log, taken out most of the honey, and left the poor bees late in the fall, when winter was approaching, to make haste to gather all the honey they could from the latest flowers to avoid starvation in the winter. And that's where I'll stop today. And next week I'll read more. Some of the topics coming up: hungry for knowledge, borrowing books, paternal opposition, early rising proves a way out of difficulties, inventions, an early rising machine, novel clocks, hygrometers, and so on. Pretty soon we are going to be finding out some of the inventions that John Muir created when he went to college in Madison. I've been reading The Story of My Boyhood and Youth by John Muir. If you've missed some of these readings, go to WDRT.org and look at the archive podcasts. They're all there, plus lots of his stories about Alaska and loads more. This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.